Okay, hello and welcome to the first of the South Pacific Weather Training Teleclass Lectures of 2008. My name is Jane Barnett and I'm speaking to you from Christchurch, New Zealand. Our speaker today is Professor Peter Curson, and I had the pleasure of meeting Peter in Wellington last year, where he presented his work on epidemics and pandemics as a keynote lecture and a Weather Training Teleclass session. Originally from New Zealand, Peter is Emeritus Professor of Medical Geography at Macquarie University and Professor of Population and Security in the Centre for International Security Studies, it's quite a mouthful, Peter, at the University of Sydney. He's well qualified to speak on his topic of climate change and human health today, as he is the former Dean of Environmental and Life Sciences and Head of the School of Earth Sciences at Macquarie, and was also a co-director of the Commonwealth-funded Climate Impact Centre. He's the author of a number of books, as well as many articles in the area of population, public health, and medical geography. He currently serves on a number of government and industry advisory boards in the area of infectious disease and biosecurity, and is currently working on a study of population disease and security in the Asia-Pacific region. Welcome, Peter, and thank you very much for once again contributing to the Weber Training Teleclass series.
Thank you for those kind remarks and the introduction, Jane. Well, as Jane said, today's teleclass is on the subject of climate change and human health. And although it's presented by someone down under, I'll try and make what I say generally applicable to a much wider audience. As I go through, I'll refer you and talk about some of the PowerPoint slides. There are indeed only 9 of these, but I'll talk about these as we go through and make some further comments about them, I think. Let me begin by just making a few introductory comments about climate and health, which I think probably are apt. There's no doubt that health and climate have been linked for a very long time in Western philosophy, probably since antiquity. And indeed, in the 5th century BC, Hippocrates drew attention to the fact that many diseases seemed in some way to be linked to changes in season or changes in temperature. And some years later, Aristotle developed the first really comprehensive treatise on weather and health in his 4-volume Meteorologica, which interestingly remained the standard text for many centuries and was even used in some medical schools around the turn of the 20th century. In the 18th and 19th centuries, there was tremendous interest in the links between climate and health, probably reached a peak in Europe. And I don't know much about the North American situation, but I'm sure there was scholarly interest in the links in the 19th century between climate and health. Certainly in Australia, in the latter part of the 19th century, Edward Swarbrick Hall, Australia's pioneer demographer, wrote very extensively on the links between climate and mortality, a subject which preoccupied him for much of his adult life, and he produced some quite pioneering work on the links between seasonality, temperature, and child mortality, infant mortality. He was mainly working in Hobart. Be that as it may, more recently, our increasing capacity to monitor and predict climatic variations, such as El Nino or the Southern Oscillation, ENSO cycle, together with conclusive evidence of climate change, has stimulated growing attention into the links between climate and human health. Now, this is an irony in some ways, because up until probably the turn of the 20th century, climate and health was a topic of some interest in medical schools. And then, under attack from the germ theory of disease, interest in the links between the two virtually disappeared until relatively recently, with the revival of interest in global warming and climate change. It's also interesting, I think, to speculate on the way climate directly affects human physiology and human health. And although we don't know very much about this, it would seem that many fundamental bodily processes would seem in some way linked to weather changes. For example, blood clotting time increases considerably before the passage of a cold front. Joint mobility decreases, and blood pressure rises steeply. As temperature falls, blood vessels dilate and nerve endings cease to conduct sensations. White blood cells increase after a steep barometric fall, and blood volume increases with heat stress and decreases during cold fronts. Now, many of these changes are not particularly well understood insofar as they are directly linked to health. But I think there's little doubt that some weather patterns are directly connected to things like asthma attacks, post-operative complications, arthritic conditions, heart attacks, and stroke. And I think also there's little doubt that some of us are perhaps more weather sensitive than others. And I'm thinking particularly of asthmatics, who would seem to be probably the most weather sensitive of all. Insofar as just one example, their rewarming curve is very different from non-asthmatics. And by that I mean when their body temperature falls, as it may do with a quick cold snap or the passage of a cold front, it often takes them much longer than a non-asthmatic to bring their body temperature back to a normal situation. And that has lots of interesting implications, I think, for what might trigger an attack of asthma. But it also tells us how little we really know about how much weather and climate affect our health. I mean, it's not without note that some European hospitals, for example, would not or would delay major operations during the passage of a cold front. In fact, that still, in some cases, happens in some European hospitals. In addition to that, I think temperature, humidity, rainfall, and climatic variations have undoubtedly a significant effect on the life cycle and the geographical distribution of disease vectors like mosquitoes, and indeed, they may also affect the development of some bacteria and viruses. There is a theory, for example, that respiratory viruses lie inert in our environment only to be reactivated by the first real cold snap of winter. And if that's the case, it presents a different echo view of health in some ways. But I think because climate affects us in so many ways, and because the details of how global climate may change still remain to some extent uncertain, predicting the health effects of climate change remains difficult at best. But given, I think, what is currently known about the magnitude of global warming and the links between climate and human health, future health impacts may well be quite substantial. And I think, like climate change, these health effects are likely to vary geographically, as different regions of the world are differently affected. And as I'll say in a moment, there's no doubt in my mind that they're going to vary socially among different groups in our community and our societies. So, what will climate change likely to, or what's it likely to deliver? I think there seems little argument that the world will experience some degree of climate change over the next 30 to 50 years. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has predicted that global mean temperatures could rise from between 2.4 degrees and 6.4 degrees Celsius under a high greenhouse gas emission scenario, or between 1.1 and 2.9 degrees Celsius under a low emission scenario. And if you look at my first figure, which is headed What Will Climate Change Deliver, it gives you a rough breakdown of what Australia might be expected to experience, and some of this will apply to a broader audience as well. In the first place, we're probably looking at an increase in national average temperatures for the world that I've just described, but for Australia, well, somewhere between 0.4 and 2 degrees within the next 20-odd years, and possibly between 1 and 6 degrees within the next 50 years. The implications for that are profound in some ways, and I'll talk about those in a moment. Secondly, there's no doubt we're looking at more heat waves, fewer frosts and drier winters. And that may have its upside, I guess, in terms of drier winters and fewer frosts, although Australia doesn't need any more dry winters. But the heat wave situation has tremendous implications, I think, for populations both in the southern and northern hemisphere. And again, it's something I'll come back to in a moment. There's no doubt in my mind that we're looking at changes in rainfall variability, with possible reductions in parts of southern Australia and increases in the tropical north. Something probably you don't want to hear at the moment, since the tropical north in Australia is experiencing incredible cyclones and storms at the moment. And probably there'll be more rain in western parts of New Zealand and less in the east. And I suspect there'll be regional variations in rainfall variability throughout the northern hemisphere as well. We're also looking at more severe climatic events, such as cyclones of some import to parts of the United States, storms, floods and bushfires, certainly important in the Australian scenario. And I guess possibly there'll be more El Nino events with more pronounced droughts and heavy rainfall events. One of the great ironies of living in Australia that you can experience the worst drought in 100 years and within a week parts of northern Queensland have had 6 months rain in 3 hours. The variability is amazing. I guess there's also considerable talk about possible sea level rises. That can vary, I guess. There's some debate about this, but certainly it would appear that parts of the Pacific, for example, the Pacific Islands, low-lying atolls, are considerably at risk from increasing sea level rises. It seems pretty clear to me that climate change will not impact equally upon all social groups or geographical locations, wherever you are in the world. And it's equally clear to me that some groups, by virtue of their age, their health status, their socioeconomic status, or indeed their job and or residential location, are likely to be much more vulnerable to things like climatic variability and high temperatures. I think it's also true to say that current demographic and social trends that most of the developed world is experiencing and some of the developing world beginning to experience, such as population aging, changing migration patterns as people move from rural to urban areas, increasing urbanization, and unfortunately increasing social marginality, even in developed countries like Australia and the United States and Canada, may heighten such vulnerability. Now, if you turn to the next figure, which I've actually labelled figure one, but just put that down as a down under digression, the figures are headed climate change and human health pathways. Here I've tried to just briefly encapsulate in one simple diagram some of the sort of flow pathways that one might expect of climate change affecting potential health effects and outcomes. You can see on the left, I've got a little box that's talking about human exposures to climatic effects, sea level rise, temperature change, rainfall change, climate variability, perhaps even ozone decrease, which I didn't mention, and there may be more. I think these will interact with dimensions of human vulnerability. In other words, some people are undoubtedly going to be more vulnerable, partly because of the place they find themselves in our society, which means they don't have the necessary resources to take mitigation or adaptation strategies and the like. And I'll talk about these in a little bit more detail in a moment, but some of these vulnerabilities are the rapid aging that's going on in most developed countries and some developing ones, the related increase in chronic illness and disability as we tend to get older, the medication dependence that tends to mark aging populations in developed countries, changing migration patterns, social marginalization, probably environmental degradation is also important, and as is increasing urbanization, particularly in the developing world, and undoubtedly entrenched infectious disease, and probably I should have said emerging infections there as well. But really, infectious disease is an issue that probably we should have a teleclass on in alone. I mean, the fact that so many people die from hospital-based infections in developed countries these days, that there's so much vector-borne disease, whether it's West Nile virus in the United States or dengue in Australia, and how that will be affected by climate change. I'll make a comment about that in a moment, but for the moment, back to this little diagram. There are mitigation and adaptation strategies which can interplay and perhaps lessen or, in fact, in some cases, even augment some of these effects. But in the right-hand box, following this pathway through, I've just simply deleted some potential delineated some potential health effects, like heat-related deaths and illness, extreme weather-related health effects, air quality health effects, not unimportant for asthmatics and for others, vector-borne diseases, skin cancers, respiratory deaths, water contamination, and the like. And some of these I'll go through a little bit in a little bit more detail in a moment. To come back to my point about human vulnerability, I really think it's almost a truism that the old, the poor, and in many countries the recent low-income immigrants are always likely to suffer the worst health and probably suffer most when disasters strike. I think that's almost a truism in our society, and it's a regrettable truism in some ways. But certainly there are some social demographic changes that are going on in societies like Australia, New Zealand, and North America, which will probably increase vulnerability, I think, to climatic change. And they include what I said a moment ago, the rapid growth of the age population, particularly those aged over 80 years. The growth of the old is probably the fastest growing sector in the demographic structure of many developed countries. I think there'll be increasing levels of chronic illness and disability, perhaps handicap, and certainly as we get older, increasing medication dependence. There's also a propensity of the elderly to retire to warmer parts. That's true of Australia as it is of parts of the rest of the world. And that holds considerable implications, I think, for life in a changing climate. And if you look at my next PowerPoint overhead, which is labelled Dimensions of Vulnerability, I've tried, particularly this is in the Australian context, but the principles apply much more broadly, to look at some of the dimensions of vulnerability and how they might, in fact, edge us closer to being more susceptible to the effects of climate change. And in fact, this table details some of the more important social and epidemiological changes we can probably expect in the next 30 or 50 years. There's no doubt that most populations are aging quite rapidly. And in fact, within, say, 35, 40 years, possibly there'll be 25, 27% of the Australian population will be aged over 65, and a like proportion in other countries as well. But it's the old population which is growing the most rapidly in some ways. In that period, we're probably going to see 7% of the Australian population aged over 85 as people live longer, and it's a reflection of the sort of changes in fertility over the last few decades. That's got quite considerable implications, I think, for living under a warmer climate and living in times of climate change. And it's not unrelated to the next two little headings, or the next three, in fact. There's no doubt in my mind that as people live older and longer lives, they're going to suffer a little bit more chronic illness and disability and handicap. And the proportion of people in Australia within 40-odd years or so that are suffering from a severe handicap is going to be the order of about 5 million, which is quite considerable for here, and a proportion who are disabled as well. But it's perhaps the propensity to suffer chronic illness which is going to have some important implications for living under a changing climate. There will be quite a growth in the number of people with asthma, with hypertension, people with diabetes, and people suffering musculoskeletal problems like osteoarthritis. Now, all that has implications for living and living well under a changing climate. I mean, the growth of the old, for want of a better term, the 80, 85 plus group, and the implications that has for lack of mobility, the fact that one's thermoregulatory efficiency begins to decline after about 70 or 80, that vascular responses change the capacity to deal with extreme temperatures, they're compromised in many ways, and the fact that many of these old, as I'll say in a moment, are retiring to warmer parts, thinking that that'll give them a better retirement, and the implications of that we'll go into in a moment. But there are other things. The medication dependence. In Australia, probably of the old group, more than 90% are in some ways dependent on a cocktail of medications taken every day. And as the population ages, that's going to increase as well. And I'll have more to say about that in the context of a changing climate in a few moments. But we're also, as I'm sure you're well aware, perhaps particularly from what I said in my last teleclass, that we're living at a time when infectious disease is re-emerging, that so-called new infections, and they're probably not really new, they've probably been around a while, but probably they're zoonotic, that is, they're animal infections, and some vagary of our behaviour has given them a sort of leg up or a boost and changed their distribution. But a whole range of older infections are beginning to resurge again. Hospital-based infections and antibacterial infections are beginning to appear. We're living at a time where, ironically, we once thought we'd be infection-free and we could move on to look at perhaps those other more chronic diseases which affect us, like stroke and cancer and heart attack. But in some ways, the opposite is true. While these infections may not yet kill very many of us, they're moving to play a major role in our lives. And I personally believe that the next 10 years we'll see a resurgence of a variety of infectious diseases, not only vector-borne ones, the mosquito-borne ones or tick-borne ones in the United States, but water-borne ones and a variety of ones that have come back because of the resistance to antibacterial drugs, which really remains a major problem in Western societies. I guess another factor of vulnerability undoubtedly reflects social marginalisation, social vulnerability in our society. Most Western developed countries do have a large proportion who are vulnerable in social terms, either living below the poverty line, unemployed, perhaps without medical insurance, as parts of the United States. Child poverty is high. There are particular groups in developed Western societies like Australia which are particularly vulnerable. The Aboriginal situation here in health terms is a national disgrace. And certainly you might argue that increasing social marginalisation makes people more vulnerable to climatic extremes. There's certainly also evidence of environmental degradation, which plays a role here. Chemicals, waste disposal, changes in air quality from the tremendous use of motor vehicles and the like. And I'll have more to say about all this in a moment, as I will about retirement migration. One of the characteristics of an ageing population, perhaps in some cases a slightly more affluent ageing population, has been a retirement migration to warmer coastal areas. That's true in Australia. I suspect it's true in New Zealand, and certainly it's true in the United States. And finally, my just added increasing urbanisation, which produces a whole range of problems in developing urban areas. I think climate change may indeed set a broad environmental frame or envelope for what's going to happen to us over the next 50, 60, 70 years. But to me, it seems much more likely that it will be human, social, economic, and geographical vulnerability that will determine what happens or the health outcomes. And I couldn't stress that any stronger, I think. I think it's the vulnerability of groups to not intervene in their own health for a whole range of reasons, which will edge us closer, perhaps, to not dealing very well with some of the impacts of climate change. What I want to talk about now is some examples here. And the first I want to talk about is the impact of extreme temperatures on human health, because this has been researched quite extensively. And one of the things that climate change is likely to deliver is perhaps more heat waves, more extreme episodes of high temperatures. And there's no doubt that exposures to both extreme hot and cold temperatures is associated with increased morbidity and mortality. And heat waves in particular have been shown to produce high mortality, particularly among old, frail and bedridden people, as well as those suffering from pre-existing disease, such as cardiovascular and respiratory complaints. I mean, even here in Australia, since the early years of the 19th century, about 4,500 Australians have died during heat waves. Not much, but in the context of an Australian small population, quite considerable. And if you look at the United States situation, conservative estimates indicate that there are at least 150 heat-related deaths every year in the United States. And during excessive heat waves, the toll can be much higher. In 1980, for example, in the United States, a heat wave produced at least 1,700 deaths and probably contributed to the deaths of many more people. And between 1987 and 2006, there were at least 12 episodes of extreme temperatures impacting on the health of people in the United States. And most climatic impact studies, particularly ones carried out on selected United States cities, suggest that the number of heat-related deaths will increase substantially in the next 30 to 40 years. Certainly, there's no doubt in my mind that under climate change, it seems likely that many countries will experiencing far more heat wave conditions, and that'll have a tremendous impact on vulnerable groups. Now, the next overhead I had just details a few recent heat waves, and you get some idea of the proportion of these. It's headed recent heat waves. And it looks at, well, particularly the one that occurred in Europe in 2003, which I'll talk about in a moment, which is tells you the impact of a heat wave even in developed advanced countries. I think people living in large urban areas would probably seem at greater risk from increased high temperatures. The urban heat island effect, where the canyon effect of inner city buildings with high thermal mass and low ventilation absorb and retain heat, and the waste heat from buildings, motor vehicles and trains would also probably contribute. And looking back at this table again, the 2003 heat wave in Europe, which I'm sure you all remember, is certainly a case in point. During only about 2 or 3 weeks in August, there were possibly as many as 72,000 deaths in Italy, France, or mostly in Italy and France and Spain. Most of these people were elderly, either living alone or in chronically underfunded, overcrowded and short-staffed rest homes. In France, for example, people aged over 75 accounted for more than 80% of the excess mortality. And again, that comes back to a point I made a moment ago. It's really human vulnerability which is important here. High temperatures may set an envelope, but it's within that, it's how vulnerable we are. Look again at what I've just said. Most of the people who died in 2003 in Europe were old people, either living alone without support structures, without any access to air conditioning or some way of mitigating the heat, or indeed packed, and I use the word advisably, into exceedingly underfunded and very overcrowded rest homes. That was certainly the case in France. And it certainly tells you something about the vulnerability of aged populations in our so-called developed world. The next figure I just put in is to give you some idea of the sort of geographical location of the heat wave in 2003. It shows you the actual temperature anomalies during the July-September period. And it was an extraordinary period. Perhaps not extraordinary for some people in the United States or indeed in Australia who are used to lengthy periods of very high temperatures. But the impact of that on an aging population was profound. And I think it holds plenty of messages for us. And particularly one, as I'll talk about in a little moment, is perhaps we need to actually think about producing a sort of particular health policy for an aging geriatric population in a changing climate. I've talked about that in the Australian context, but nobody's shown much interest in it, I'm afraid. The next thing I want to talk about is climatic change and infectious disease. And we've known, I think, for some time that climatic conditions affect the life cycle and distribution of infectious diseases, particularly those spread by mosquitoes, such as malaria, dengue, yellow fever, and Ross River virus. The breeding cycle of mosquitoes, the mosquitoes' biting rate, i.e. its need to take a blood meal, and the incubation period of the particular disease within the mosquito would all seem to be particularly temperature dependent. And I think the link between excessive monsoonal rains and high humidity has long been known as an initiator of malarial and dengue outbreaks in parts of Asia. Extensive spring and summer rainfall, flooding, and high temperatures remain an important trigger of diseases like Ross River virus and dengue in parts of Australia. And changes in temperature, intensifying floods and droughts resulting from global warming, may indeed initiate disease outbreaks by creating new breeding grounds for mosquitoes. Now, if you look at the next diagram, headed interactions between vector-borne infections, in brackets dengue and climate change, it just gives you a brief encapsulated flow of some of the linkages here. And although I've got dengue there, and that's been developed in the Australian context, it could well apply to malaria or to other vector-borne, mosquito-borne diseases. Certainly, human behavior, as we well know, is affecting climate change. That's on the right side, and that's producing warmer temperatures, drought, rain, drought cycle, and the like. And there's no doubt that warmer temperatures, a cycle of drought followed by rain, followed by drought, impacts very much on the life cycle of mosquitoes. It impacts on their breeding, it impacts on their geographical distribution, and it impacts on their biting behavior. Now, in the Australian scene, and that little round circle I've got on the right there, which reads introduction of a virus, we don't have dengue in Australia. It's not endemic, but we do have the mosquito vector, which once had a very wide distribution in Australia, and today is probably, again, I'll say in a moment, is concentrated in northern parts of Queensland. Every so often, a tourist, perhaps from Southeast Asia, with antibodies to dengue, comes in to tour Queensland, is bitten by a local mosquito, and indeed from that one encounter, we actually get regular major epidemics of dengue in parts of northern Queensland every couple of years, often involving thousands of people. So it shows you how finely balanced is the sort of epidemiological social regime of a country like Australia. But looking to the left of the diagram, human behavior can indeed impact directly on vector life cycle. And I'll talk about how what we do in our homes and our backyards and in our farming techniques can indeed affect the life cycle of mosquitoes, their distribution, their biting behavior, and in fact encourage a much wider geographical range. And all this impacts, I think, on disease incidence. And I'll come back to some of these points in a moment. But that's only meant to be a very rough encapsulating diagram. Certainly, I believe that even a simple thing like increasing temperatures, even by a small amount, will produce changes in the current distribution of mosquitoes. Certainly throughout parts of the world, mosquitoes are now being found at higher altitudes than they ever were found before. And people argue that's due to a slight change in warming temperatures. And this is particularly the case in the Australian scene with coming back to dengue again. And I mean, for many of you listening to this, you probably think dengue is something that probably should only be found, well, I shouldn't say that, is only found in parts of Southeast Asia and Asia. But dengue has been associated with Australia since the late 19th century. And the mosquito vector, Aedes aegypti, was once limited by temperature thresholds in Australia to very low altitudes and areas of very high temperature and seasonal downpours. But that's not always been the case. And if you look at the next figure, which looks at the distribution of the dengue mosquito in Australia, and you can see on the left of the diagram, it shows you the current distribution. It's very much a tropical northern Queensland, northern Australian distribution now. But back in the 1920s, and probably through to the 1940s, that mosquito was found all over the eastern seaboard of Australia, right down south of Sydney. And there were evidence of some extraordinary epidemics of dengue. The 1925-26 epidemic, which I'm, that distribution illustrates of the mosquito there, actually caused 560,000 cases of dengue on the eastern seaboard of Australia. Now, bear in mind that the total population of the eastern seaboard was probably only about 1.8 million in those years. So 500,000 people had dengue in about 3 or 4 months. And in some small towns north of Sydney and northern New South Wales and parts of Queensland, 85% of the population had dengue in 1925-26. Now, at that time, there were very few deaths, I might say. Dengue, unless it's the latest dengue hemorrhagic fever, is not a life-threatening illness for a well population with reasonable nutrition and no protein deficiency and the like. I think there are only about 14 deaths. I actually forgotten. There might have been, about 100 deaths, I think, out of 560,000 cases. But the point I'm making here is that it's quite possible that with climate warming, we'll see an expansion of the distribution of that mosquito vector back to perhaps the days in the 1920s when it occupied a good proportion of the eastern seaboard. Now, the irony was the reasons for its distribution in the 1920s probably reflected human events more than biophysical ones. It was a time when most Australians had water tanks. The trains running through the whole of the eastern seaboard had troughs of water and water tanks to fill up the engine. Most Australians had what was known as a cool guard safe, and you probably won't know what that is, but that was just a cabinet that sat in little sources of water to stop ants getting into the safe. Mosquitoes bred like mad in all these situations. And Aedes aegypti also bred around the wharves. It was beautifully adapted, as it is today, to living around human habitations. Today, situations have slightly changed, although there is a move back to rain tanks in rural Australia. But it's probably a change in temperature, a change in the variability of rain and drought that is going to perhaps produce a change in the distribution of mosquitoes. If that happens, and the dengue mosquito has been here for, well, probably since the early period of Australian settlement, if not before, and the fact that there are epidemics every couple of years, it holds lots of implications for Australia in the next 30 to 40 years or so. And I might say there is no cure for dengue. The usual medical intervention is simply to address the symptoms and not the cure. And that's one of the great ironies of health in many developed countries, just to digress for a moment, is that if something doesn't kill us but just sort of inconveniences us, like dengue or Ross River fever, we tend to live with it and we don't do much about it. If it kills us, we find a cure for it. And I'll have more to say about that in aspirin in a moment. I guess malaria is another example, and I could be talking about malaria here as well. Approximately about 2 billion of the world's population remain at risk from malaria. And generally, malaria tends to exist where minimum winter temperatures exceed about 16 degrees centigrade. But global warming is predicted to produce warmer winters in many places of the world, and that's certainly going to have an impact on the distribution of the mosquito vector, I think. And that applies widely through many parts of Asia. And it may well affect parts of the United States and once malaria affected parts of northern Australia. So there are some interesting developments here, I think, for the future. I think human exposure to waterborne infections may also be influenced by climate change. On the one hand, sea level rise, frequent flooding may well contaminate drinking and recreational water supplies. In New Zealand, for example, where Campylobacter appears to be widespread in river and shallow groundwater, heavy downpours and widespread flooding may have important health implications, certainly in parts of northern Queensland at the moment, where they've had the worst floods for probably a century, particularly around Mackay. There are lots of implications for the contamination of drinking water and the like. In the United Kingdom, for example, coming back to Campylobacter, Campylobacter outbreaks in the early 1990s associated with water outnumbered those associated with poultry. Most people think of Campylobacter in chickens these days, but in fact, it's also significantly in the water. I think also high temperatures may affect the institutional and home preparation storage of foodstuffs, with leading to more episodes of gastrointestinal infections. And my next overhead looks at the interactions between climate change and foodborne infections. And I think I could say reasonably confidently that gastrointestinal infections are one of the great growth industries of developed countries in the last few years. The number or the expansion of cases has been extraordinary in Australia, and I suspect that's true elsewhere as well. Part of that, I'm certain myself, comes from the sloppy institutional preparation of food or the sloppy delivery and storage of food, but also it comes about from home preparation and the storage of foodstuffs and the handling of poultry and then the handling of other foodstuffs. But I also think for a long time we agitated for the want of a better term, pure, in inverted commas, foodstuffs. We didn't want much salt in the food we bought. And I think we didn't really fully understand that when you get less preservatives, less salt in food, food doesn't necessarily keep as long as it once did. And you add the sort of wild card of us getting warmer and hotter temperatures and a bit of sloppy food preparation, and it's no wonder that gastrointestinal and food infections are a real growth industry. And this variable is simply a bit like the one, a bit like the one before, is simply showing just that. I mean, human behavior linked to climate change, heavy rainfall episodes, floods, sea level rise, water supply contamination, some agricultural practices on the one hand, all of that can lead, allied to warmer temperatures, to an increase in sort of gastrointestinal from food problem, foodborne infections. And this, I talked about simple factor of human behavior being a factor, our pursuit of pure and natural foodstuffs. I can remember once living in England, and I was always amazed at the number of people who would drive for miles out to the farmyard gate to buy what they believed was pure, unadulterated milk straight from the farm. Unfortunately, a lot of this wasn't pasteurized, and it gave rise to some interesting infections. But I often wonder if we really know what we do when we seek, for want of a better term, pure food. I think increased climate variability accompanying warming may also fuel outbreaks of other vector-borne diseases. Warm winters followed by hot, dry summers would seem to have played a role in the United States, for example, in the spread of St. Louis encephalitis and West Nile virus. While a cycle of drought, intense rainfall followed by drought, would seem linked to the emergence of that new rodent-borne infection, hantavirus, pulmonary syndrome, in parts of the southwest of the United States. Arguably, climate change may accelerate the emergence and transfer of new animal diseases to human populations. I mean, most of the so-called new infections that have appeared over the last 30, 40 years have actually been zoonotic, i.e. in origin. That is, they've been animal infections. And because of some vagary of our behavior, we've translated them into something that has really affected us. And I think that's possibly that climate change is going to play a role in that as well. And in some ways that brings me to talk about respiratory infections, and particularly asthma. Now, in Australia, as in many other countries, respiratory infections are generally more sensitive to weather and climate and much more common during the cold winter months. It is possible that milder winters, which we could expect under a climate change scenario, will lower the incidence of respiratory diseases during winter. On the other hand, asthma, which I talked about before, remains probably the most sensitive of all human diseases to weather and climate. And over the past 10 years, more than 5,000 Australians have died from asthma, most prematurely, and at least 2 million Australians and 600,000 New Zealanders suffer from asthma. And a recent survey of young children under 8 in the United States indicated that a little over 9% currently suffer from asthma, about 7 million. And even in the United Kingdom, 1 in 5 households have a person suffering from asthma. Some think asthma is one of the real major problems of the next 20 to 30 years. And I think in some ways climate change is going to have an important effect on the prevalence of asthma. Changes in temperature, humidity, and rainfall are likely to influence the life cycle and seasonality of a wide range of allergens and irritants that produce or initiate an asthma attack. Things like pollens, molds, fungi, dust mites, as well as perhaps influencing the degree of dampness in some of our houses. And I think the balance of evidence strongly suggests that a significant impact of climate change can be seen in animal and plant populations. And climate change will impact quite considerably on aeroallergens, particularly pollens, in many parts of the world. And it appears that plants produce a greater quantity of pollen with increases in temperature. And climate change, I think, can be expected to change the temporal and the spatial distribution of pollen and result in earlier pollen seasons and a wider distribution of pollen-bearing plants. And I think all that has tremendous implications for those asthmatics who are atopic or reactive to aeroallergens like pollens. And given the tremendous number of people who suffer from asthma and the implications it has for lifestyle, I think this is quite significant for the next 20, 30, 50 years or so. And for a while, it was quite difficult to get people to realize that in the medical profession, that something like asthma might well be impacted on by climate change. Just a few other comments, I think. There are undoubtedly going to be other extreme weather events which are impacted on considerably by climate change. And I think there's going to be a change in the frequency and the magnitude, as I indicated earlier, of extreme weather events such as severe storms, cyclones, floods, droughts and bushfires. Most of these have caused substantial population displacements in the past, as well as claimed thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of lives, and affected the lives of many million more and caused billions of dollars in property damage. And you see the cyclone season in parts of the United States, but also in parts of extreme weather conditions in parts of North Tropical Australia. Another thing I want to briefly mention, and again I've referred to this earlier, is the impact of changing temperatures, changing climate change, on medication use in an aging population. I indicated that one of the indexes of vulnerability was not only an aging population, but particularly an old population, but the high level of medical dependence. More than 90% of all Australians, probably aged over 75, 80, regularly rely on medications to control fluid, heart, blood pressure problems, as indeed well as things like asthma, diabetes, and arthritis. Many take a cocktail of such medications daily, for want of a better term. Now, there is some evidence to suggest that when temperatures and humidity increase, such medications don't work as well as they once did. Now, I don't remember doctors telling old people who are planning to retire to Florida or parts of northern Queensland that's a likely outcome, that the absorption rate of the drugs they're taking just to keep living a normal life are not going to act probably as well as they had done when they lived in the southern part of Australia or another part of the United States. And I think the problem is further exacerbated by what I've just said. People are retiring to warmer parts. And that last diagram I've given you, retirement migrations, simply refers to the sort of migration of the elderly in Australia and how many of them are moving to northern Queensland or to parts of northern New South Wales where the temperatures are much warmer. And I'm sure you can think of examples in Australia, in the United States and New Zealand of exactly the same. But these people are moving to a place where the summers are hotter, the winters are hotter, where there's more vector-borne disease, in fact, mosquitoes. Most of them are dependent on quite a few medications, and rarely is there any comment about how those medications might react. And I guess as we get older, and we are dependent on those sort of things, and we do want to flee from the cold south to the warm north somewhere, or in the other opposite in the United States, then we need to understand some of the implications of that, I think. And I don't think we do at the moment. Right, just a brief comment before I conclude on adaptations, options, and constraints. What should we be doing about all this? Well, there seems little doubt to me that we need to firstly appreciate current vulnerability to climate change and to fully appreciate there are certain groups in our society who may well be at greater risk than others. That's the first thing. Secondly, I think perhaps we need to even develop particular policies for the aged and the most vulnerable in our society in a changing climate. Something I alluded to a moment ago, a geriatric climate change and health policy. So the GPs know that they perhaps have to tell old people, particularly very old people who are retiring to older places, that perhaps the drugs may not work as they once did and the like. We certainly need public education and awareness campaigns that include alert and response mechanisms for heat waves, ongoing communication, as I said, about medication use in a warmer climate, public health messages about water safety, particularly during times of extreme climatic events. We need more information about living with vector-borne diseases and the preparation and handling of food, both institutional and in the home. I think we need to raise awareness and to understand that some of our behaviour needs to change. I think understanding our vulnerability, particularly to something like emerging infectious diseases, is really a first step in addressing adaptive capacity. And adaptation involves the desire and the ability to modify behaviour, as well as to institute broad health infrastructure changes, whether it's mosquito control programs, improved surveillance programs, and the like. Let me give an example of this. For example, I've talked about a lot about dengue, and I apologize for that. But dengue remains quite a problem in the Australian scene, particularly in northern Queensland. And it's a classic example of the mosquito vector having adapted beautifully to living with people. For example, it's been discovered that most of the epidemics of dengue in towns like Townsville, Port Douglas and parts of northern Queensland have actually occurred because the mosquito has been breeding in bird baths or sources of water under pot plants or in discarded plastic cartons in the backyard, and we all know what that means. It's an element of human behaviour which has produced this, not the mosquito, and we need to understand that. And we need to do something about it, particularly in a changing climate where we're likely to see more episodes of dengue. I think in addition to that, we need to develop perhaps heat emergency response plan, preparations prior to the onset of heat wave, perhaps even a database of those who might be most at risk, people in nursing homes and tenements in the inner city, low-income immigrants and the like. I know that the United States had a policy in parts of the southern parts of the United States to actually bus old people to air-conditioned shelters during major heat waves. But I think we need to go further. We need to ensure that nursing homes are adequately built and staffed to actually handle climatic change. We need to be assured that the monitoring and medication use of elderly people in such environments. We need to understand the links between temperature extremes and droughts, and indeed things like mental health, particularly in farming areas, where the drought creates a feeling of absolute depression, and we've seen plenty of that in Australia. And there are lots of elements here, I think, which are really important. Well, I've talked a long time, and let me just make a few very quick concluding comments. I think forecasting the climatic change impacts on human health certainly involves a lot of uncertainties. I think, like futures research, it relies on scenario-based risk assessments, which often don't factor in the vagaries of human behaviour, and in particular, the adaptive and mitigation strategies that people might adopt. And not all people are equal in this. The most vulnerable do not have the resources, the understanding, or the ability to perhaps do some of these things. I think climate change would seem to have the potential to affect many aspects of our health in ways that are not always direct, but often complex and synergistic. And I think the final effect will depend upon a number of factors, including the rate of environmental change, things like the reemergence of infectious disease, certainly the vulnerability of sectors of our population, and most certainly the extent to which human adjustments and adaptations can be made, and the various mitigative strategies that we might consider to implement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter. That's excellent. It's a fascinating lecture. You presented with us with some startling figures today, and I think I probably will listen to this lecture again and still get yet more information out of it.
I'm wondering what influence climate change might have on our long-anticipated influenza pandemic.
Well, now, that's a question and a half, isn't it? I don't know, actually. It's quite possible. I mean, most influenza viruses are circulating quite normally among wildlife in parts of South Asia anyway. Certainly, it's quite possible that climate change will change the migration path of wild birds. It may influence the interaction of wild birds with domesticated birds. Some people even argue that temperature change, climatic variability, the impact of a drought cycle followed by heavy rainfall may actually produce some slight change in the virus itself. It's interesting, there's nothing definitive on all of that, but I certainly think that there's a good chance that major climate change in parts of South Asia will have tremendous impact on a variety of infectious agents like influenza viruses.
I suppose one for me might be with the experience that you've had, Peter, you know, as an advisor to governments, how seriously they're taking on board the information and advice that you're giving them. Can you see policy changes happening?
Well, the greatest irony of all of this, Jane, was that when we were doing our work on climate change and health back in the 90s, nobody was interested in it at all. And it's only recently, in the last few years, that climate change has sort of taken a major place on the human forum. I've argued for a while in Australia that we need to understand human vulnerability to climate change, particularly in the health circumstances, and that means putting it in the context of what's happening socially in the community, what's happening in terms of epidemiological and demographic trends, and indeed we need to do something, as I mentioned, simply like consider a particular health policy for an ageing population in a changing climate. So far, I've had no, well, up until the recent government, and I can't speak for them, I've had no sympathetic hearing at all.
Well, good luck with that. It's certainly given lots of food for thought on this. In closing, I'd like to thank you very much, Peter, for your contribution to this year's teleclass. It's been an eye-opening session, which I've certainly really enjoyed. On the final slide of the presentation, you'll see the rest of the South Pacific teleclass series listed. We will once again this year be broadcasting live in August from the National Division of Infection Control Nurses Conference, which this year is going to be held in Hamilton. So if any of you would like to visit that conference as well, it will, I'm sure, be an exciting program. I do hope that you'll be able to join us for some, if not all, of these teleclasses. But until then, thank you very much for listening in. And from all of us here in Christchurch and Sydney, goodbye for now.
That's it.